I am happy to announce our 2024 Banking with Life client-only event. It's going to happen Friday, October 25th, beginning with a pre-event social mixer. The day of the event is Saturday the 26th, followed by an after party. It's going to happen downtown Fort Worth. I will be speaking there. Others will be speaking as well. You'll have the opportunity to meet me, and I'm looking forward to meeting you. You'll have the opportunity to meet the whole Banking with Life team and a room full of people that practice the infinite banking concept from all over the country. Last year, we had about 130 people from 30 different states. The year before that was really good, too. This year is going to be even better. We're going to have educational presentations and talks, and that should be important to you if you're practicing the infinite banking concept. I can't wait to see you. So earlier this year, my friend Liz Diddy came down and recorded an episode that went long. So we divided it into part one and part two. Part one is episode 221. Part two is episode 222. So it's unscripted, very conversational. But during our great conversation, three particular topics came up: indexed universal life, the laddering strategy, and HELOCs. So we pulled those clips out of those two episodes to make this episode. And we did it because I think it's very important and very interesting. We had fun, and I hope you enjoy listening.
There's just one in particular thing that I keep seeing in my feed everywhere about, and it's probably because of the things I research, but maybe not everybody's coming across this, and it's just me, because this is kind of like stuff I like to do for fun. I like to look at ways to save on taxes and, you know, things to write off for my businesses and so on and so forth. But this IUL thing,
Index Universal Life, is just getting
pushed all over the place by these young kids. Influencers don't know any different. They're probably into that company that I almost went to. Pushing this. And what I remember hearing when I watched the videos about somewhere, Nelson said that these things are like zombies because at some point they eat themselves, and I'm like, these are so dangerous. And so I put comments out there under their videos to be like, hey guys, just, you know, like, have you thought this through?
Do you get beat up? Do you get attacked?
A little, but yeah. I'm trying to flip them.
Yeah. You know, it's a I'm a pretty busy guy, you know, I mean, relatively, and when I It's entertaining for me sometimes when I look at the comments on different life insurance, whatever it is, when it comes to life insurance and IBC or whatever, infinite banking on social media, to stroll through the comments. Man, it's like the blind leading the freaking blind.
So true.
You know, I'm not surprised, but you said dangers, and I knew you. She wrote down IUL before we turned the mics on, right? And I told her that, you know, I have three short videos that I talk about IUL on a very 30,000 foot view of what's wrong with them and why they're wrong and what's likely going to happen. But then I also shared with her, and I'll share with you now, that, you know, I'm currently in the middle of doing a very in-depth dive into IUL, because I see it all the time too. Yeah. And see these young people, God bless them, they don't know what they think they know. And then you have the guys in the IBC world or in the world of infinite banking, and they slam on the guys that infinite banking or whole life, they slam on the whole life guys as if they just don't know, right? If you structure it just right, then all of those things don't happen. And it's the same argument that in the world of infinite banking, we're trying to go cash on cash as soon as possible. So you have to contort the policy structure, and it's, they don't know or they don't care the fragility that adds to a whole life policy. So the IUL guys that are saying, yeah, you can do infinite banking with IUL, they don't want to mention what Nelson wrote about IUL and becoming your own banker. And he mentions it. There's one page there. He mentioned that he'd never sold it, and he certainly wouldn't buy it, quote unquote. But it's the same argument. Well, those guys don't know how to structure it just right. So it's like you, you know, the financial agent guru have discovered a life insurance company's software to build an illustration, and you can manipulate the numbers so it never shows a mech, right, or whatever. It's the same argument, just applied to a different product.
Right.
But there's a... And Nelson gives you the background of Universal Life. So originally it was Universal Life, came out by E.F. Hutton investment firm. You know, E.F. Hutton speaks, everybody listens. That used to be their slogan. So the stockbrokers wanted to compete with the life insurance industry, right? Because life insurance was paying more than bonds. And, you know, you have all the wonderful characteristics of just typical life insurance in the 70s. Right. Didn't even have the dynamic PUA, and whole life is wearing them out. So they we want to be all things to all people. So we go to the insurance companies and say, hey, man, we want to, you know, be able to compete with whole life insurance. And, you know, you can make a name and be famous for yourself. AXA, that, you know, I don't want to beat them up too bad. But OK. And then you had Ralph Nader coming along about the same time, the consumer protectionist. Oh, my gosh, you got to protect the people that don't know anything, can't think for themselves, from these evil life insurance companies. You know, and that's continued throughout, you know, Dave Ramsey, Susie Orman, and all the other guys. Gary North is like, oh, my God, you know what the insurance agent makes in commission? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I want to know what they make for saying those things. Yeah, that's right. What I want to know.
Yeah, well, you don't accumulate
$50 million an awful lot of money to say certain things and be a talking head for certain things.
Without a license, so you can say anything. And then you get promoted. Yeah, where do they tell you to put their money? I wonder who is paying them.
Yeah,
you talk about how much. I wonder who's paying them.
I got opinions, and I'm going to try real hard not to say them.
I love you. I appreciate you. You say what you want to say. Okay. So you have this coming against the life insurance companies, right? And the life insurance companies, we've talked about many times, they wouldn't even defend themselves. You know, the only thing worse than a bad argument is a weak defense. I mean, they don't even embrace their heritage back to your grandfather's day, your grandfather's days, right? Who are you? Go in the basements and look at your records, life insurance companies, see your heritage. I can go on, and I have, but I won't today. Okay.
Yeah.
So all this is coming, so... It's like Ralph Nader, you want to unbundle whole life insurance because it's, you know, what is the rate of return? What is the cash value? What is this? And look at the cost of the death benefit. You want to unbundle it so the poor, unsuspecting, unable to think American public can make a good decision, you know, narrowing it down to term and price of term for death benefit, the price of whole life or death benefit. And so the life insurance companies, they acquiesce. They want to be all things to all people, right? They want to be a financial services firm. So they came out with Universal Life. And you cannot unbundle whole life insurance, no matter how hard you try. You can't do it. But the best thing that they could do was come up with the Universal Life. Have a side account that earns an interest rate. And then you have an internal rate of return. It's just a term life insurance. You're pricing the death benefit for the purest cost of the death benefit term. Well, wait, interest rates were about 10, 11, and 12% back then too. Well, who can't make those numbers look good if you have a 10% rate of or 12% rate of return or 10% rate of return on Universal Life? So you have the accumulation side, unbundled, the side account to earn an interest rate. And then you have that coupled with the pure cost of a death benefit, increasing term. That is the fundamental structure of Universal Life.
And that's the caveat right there. The increasing term, which has an increasing premium.
There's an increase. They call it COI, cost of insurance, in a Universal Life policy.
And that's the thing that nobody tells you.
Mm-hmm.
This sucker is going to suddenly one day, you're going to get a bill for your premium and you're going to be like, I have to pay what?
Yeah.
Where am I going to get that?
And then you're going to drop it.
And then you're going to drop it. You're going to be too old, possibly, or have something going on with you.
Can't qualify.
That you can no longer qualify to have a new asset, and you've just lost everything that you've done.
Yeah.
Everything's gone.
I say it all the time because it's true. You remember W.C. Fields? You may be too young. Black and white movie star. Look him up. Just Google W.C. Fields and 2 out of 3 ain't bad. He said, you know, one time in a film, it's like, well, the broker made money. The firm made money. And 2 out of 3 ain't bad. Who do you think the third one he's talking about? It's you, the consumer.
That's right.
That's the beginning of universal life. So look, as interest rates came down, then that 12% side account wasn't doing it.
When you just said that right now, I went, oh my gosh, what are interest rates doing right now? This is so dangerous because people are going to hear the interest rates are going up. This is going to be even better for you now.
Yeah.
Like, this is the way to go.
Well, the life insurance companies are like, okay, well, interest rates are down. The cost of insurance, you know, oh, we're living longer and all of those things. The cost of insurance hasn't changed. It's still going to go up. You may be living longer. It just means you're going to be paying a higher premium or higher cost of insurance the older you get. So they came out with variable universal life.
Oh, that sounds great.
So now the side account is they're like mini mutual funds or sub accounts. So interest rate, you can't get 10 or 12% in interest rate we use for universal life. So we come out with variable universal life. Oh, I don't know, sometime in the 90s while the markets were going crazy. So the sub accounts, they can produce, you know, 10, 12%, right? Like everybody says, where you asked earlier, where is this asset that I can get 12% year over year over year over year for the next 30 years?
Guaranteed.
Yeah, it doesn't exist. So they did the sub accounts with VUL. Since it's a security, now you have to have a license to sell securities, and it's coupled with the rising cost of insurance.
Yeah, I keep seeing these kids talk about, okay, so what it does is it goes into these, you know, into the, you get to play the stock market with this. And I'm like, oh, this is a horrible idea, people. Like, you know.
And then, well, along about, I don't know when, but along about 2000, because, you know, they obviously discovered by observation that the market doesn't always go up, right? So that rate of return of 10 or 12% doesn't always filter down. Net of fees, net of cost of insurance, policy fees, and all the other fees. So then they came out with equity indexed universal life. You don't actually have to put the side account is an index or a series of indices, S&P 500, whatever. They create their own on a daily basis. Who's they? Wall Street. Said, look, we just created this index for you. Life insurance companies, won't you use this? You'll pay us fees, but look at how you can illustrate it. So they came out with index universal life, right, where your money's not actually in the market. We're just going to follow an index. And we just use this big upside. You can earn 110% a cap, you know, on this index. And the floor is zero. So they always say, well, you can't lose money. Oh, okay. Maybe in the index, you can't lose money. You pay a premium. All of the costs come out. That net premium then is allocated to an index. And it may go up and it may go down. Let's say it goes down and you just earn zero. See, you didn't lose any money. You didn't earn any either. Yeah, and then the increasing cost of insurance comes out. So that's
I earned nothing to be able to pay for the premium that's coming.
Yeah. So if you carried that out long enough, because look, just draw an exponential curve. You know, if you're a visual person on a sheet of paper, there's an exponential curve. And this represents, you know, you, Liz, only have one exponential curve in your whole lifetime, only one. And you can start that and stop that as many times as you want to. And every time you do stop it, you've got to restart it. And with life insurance, there's an exponential curve. And if you have a whole life insurance policy or any life insurance policy, it's going to follow your life. Okay, so just think this through. Well, I don't want to get off of equity index universal life, and I'm not. So you draw the exponential curve. That is also the cost of insurance. So it does rise. It looks really, really good when you're young, the universal life. They illustrate fabulously.
Yeah.
Fabulously. Oh, and it's not a mech. Then there's a 7-pay test. That's the initial mech test. And then there are secondary mech tests. They occur going forward. All of this matters. It may be too much minutiae or too much detail, but I'm telling you, look at that exponential curve. That cost of insurance is going up on a guaranteed basis every year. And the company retains the right to increase it above what was illustrated.
Ooh.
Oh, just go Google up if you wish. Fine. If you don't, fine. IUL, Equity Index Universal Life. Oh, yeah. They dropped the equity, right? Oh, it's a marketing ploy. Now it's not EIUL. Now it's just Index Universal Life. Right. I wonder why they did that. Okay. Just go Google up all of the lawsuit history. And there, look, there's a lot of lawsuits with all the life insurance company, the mutual companies, the stock companies, all of that. But look at the basis of the lawsuits. So the majority of the lawsuits on Index Universal Life, it is because of the cost of insurance, COI. And it increases on a guaranteed basis. And then the company, like I said, has a right to raise the cost of insurance above that. And hence, these policies, there's one day, it's a matter of time. The further out you go on that exponential curve, you're going to get a bill for $27,000 premium that you're only paying $2,000 for. And you were only paying $2,000, and the rest of that money was coming from the side account. So it was cannibalizing itself, hence the zombie policies.
So you're actually not accruing anything from that percentage because it's going towards paying the premium and keeping.
Well, you would accrue it, and if your premium is above your stated premium, the cost of insurance is above your stated premium, then it will take from that side fund to pay that difference.
Which, what are you building?
You're building profits for the life. That's the most profitable product a life insurance company has when it comes to life insurance by volume.
Yeah. Not for you.
Not for you.
For them.
Right.
Yeah. So I just thank you for going over that.
30,000.
Yeah. Sorry. I was just like, oh man.
What do you want?
I actually really wanted to go back to the client only event.
Okay.
Because David, Nelson's son-in-law,
David Stearns
from the Nelson Nash Institute, mm-hmm. and he's the head of that now. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. He's a co-board member. He owns Infinite Banking LLC. He owns all the copyright and the trademark and the books and the royalties to becoming your own banker.
Right. Yep. So he's standing up there at the event, and he tells his story. He tells a story of a woman who's probably my age, who also got an inheritance like me. And he's explaining how she went somewhere. She shows up to him and says, hey, I have all of these policies here, and can you help me understand what's going on and how I can fix this? And he starts looking at her policies, and he's explaining to us that she'd gone to someone who had set her up with this laddering strategy. And I don't understand all the details of that other than you buy a policy and then you use the cash value in that policy to buy the next policy. But what had happened is they'd stretched it out so much that she couldn't keep up with the premiums mm-hmm. and the interest to keep them in force. And he says, I can't fix this. And he's like, she lost all these assets she'd created. And it just kind of hit me like a ton of bricks because I was like, I didn't know enough. I could have gotten the wrong advice and been stuck in a similar situation, and that would have been crushing. I'm heartbroken for her.
Sure. The laddering, you know, that's quote unquote strategy, it's a commission revenue gen for the agent or advisor who promotes it, in my opinion. And so let's say, here's how it ultimately works. Whatever the details were in their case, I have no idea. Take $100,000 in premium and you buy a policy. And you typically build, they typically build Frankenstein-type policies where you have as much cash available as early as possible, something similar to 90-10 or 85-15, where 90% or 85% of the premium is paid to the PUA, the paid-up additions rider, and then the other 10 or 15% of the premium is paid to a base premium, a base whole life policy. So you have a lot of liquidity in the first year. And then you collateralize that 90% in cash value you have from policy one. Right. So now you have a $90,000 loan check in hand. These are my numbers, my examples. I've seen many of them and I have helped many people get out of them. You can't always, sometimes it gets so bad it all has to be burnt down, and that's a tragedy. Mm-hmm. And hence part of the reason why I rail on the noise. And I know a lot of agents and advisors listen to this, and I appreciate you, and I appreciate the ones that appreciate me, the ones that, you know, I make angry. You know, it's like, God bless you. That's your choice. But you have a $90,000 check in hand. You go buy another policy, right? Mm-hmm. And so then you have about $80,000 in cash value or loan value. Then you go buy another policy and another policy. So it's laddering policies, and the whole scheme or presentation, and they're all, they typically always use, they cherry pick time, and they're not forthcoming, or they don't, it's not a complete presentation of an outstanding loan. There's so many things wrong with that. It's not even funny.
Right.
And the life insurance companies don't like it. When they figure out what you're doing, you know, hopefully they cancel your contract. But you wind up with, so you're trying to, the promotion is along the lines of, well, you just pay $100,000 in and you're buying all these policies with that same cash flow. Where you're creating these outstanding loans that are going to compound. Right, because the loan repayment is never considered or talked about, right? And the death benefit doesn't matter. I'm only doing it for cash and all these things. And I've not seen one single time that has been successful.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there's an IBC expert guru out there that does it all the time. Okay. And I don't want to sound harsh. You know, there's an exception to every rule.
Sure.
But you have someone who does not understand necessarily the infinite banking concept, much less life insurance, and the promoters don't understand life insurance, in my opinion, either, or they wouldn't promote it. And they sure didn't get that from anything associated or affiliated with Nelson Nash. Not one ounce of any of that presentation, demonstration, design, strategy, whatever you want to call it, came from Nelson Nash. That is not infinite banking.
The book is not that long. It's really quick to read, and it's not in there.
It's not in there.
I've read it.
Any video that you find on Nelson, where inclusion is never in there. But the people that promote that, well, you know, they know who Nelson Nash was, so they can say his name, and they can say infinite banking or infinite banking concepts, and you know, they can say anything they want. So that's kind of the, you know, 30,000 foot view of the laddering strategy.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So that explains why it didn't work for her, because all of a sudden she's got 3, 4, 5 policies that she's got to come up with.
Premium
and interest, because the interest from the first one that she took on the loan to get the second one, and now that one has interest, and then the next one has interest, and the next one has interest.
Compounding.
And it's like, are you making so much money a year that you have to have that many storehouses today to fit that all into?
Yeah.
Right? Are you looking at making $1 million? Well, maybe this is a strategy for you. But if you're, you know, a regular person, like, okay. You know, even if I got an inheritance, just because I got an inheritance doesn't mean I'm going to be able to grow that money.
Or you're going to get another one.
Or I'll get another one. Right.
You know, and look, most of the time, and let me say, because I can hear in my mind the potential comments that I go, well, that's a legitimate strategy if you're expecting a windfall of $1 million next year. What if the windfall doesn't occur?
Yeah.
You know,
what if they change change the beneficiaries or the stipulations right at the last second. Like, you can't count on things, but you have to educate yourself so that if that happens for you, you know what to do with the money, right?
Yeah.
And that's the moment where people are just like, what is it? You're blinded, right? There's an excitement and an anticipation, and then there's this overwhelming, oh my gosh, you know, it's like the dog that catches the rabbit and doesn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so you can't count on that thing. But if it does happen, like, have you done the research? Are you ready to manage what's coming your way? You know?
And I'll move on, but there are better, legitimate, stable foundations and solutions to the laddering strategy.
Sure.
But, you know, if you receive an inheritance like that, and not always, but most of the time, you know, and if you receive a large inheritance, you know, I mean, how many large windfalls are we actually going to enjoy in our life? I don't know. The future is unknown. But it's not like you get an inheritance every year, every 2 years, or what have you. And then when you don't do your homework on the infinite banking concept, right, and it's presented to you with all the smoke and mirrors and the pixie dust, and it looks too good to be true. It probably is. you know, then you put your money into it. Of course, then, you know, your awareness goes up and it's like, oh my gosh, you're probably penciling the numbers over and over. And I always say, and I say it for a reason, you know, there's never a problem until there's a problem. You know, there's no telling how many years, maybe that worked great for a year or two. I don't know. Right. But the point in time came whenever she needed help, and whoever promoted that to her may be answering her phone calls, may be in the Caribbeans, may be in another industry. I don't know.
May no longer be an insurance agent at all. But say something about HELOCs. That people will talk you into doing a HELOC.
Yeah. Well, here's, and I'm not opposed to HELOCs.
Right.
I'm not. What I am opposed to is the marketing that you do the HELOC. Now, let's think about this. A home equity line of credit. So you're collateralizing the number one asset that the majority of Americans put their money in. That's mm-hmm. where the majority of their wealth is in their home, the equity of their home, and in a qualified retirement plan, TSP, 401k, whatever it is, 403b, whatever it is, IRAs. The majority of their capital is there. The majority of their wealth is there. I am opposed to collateralizing one of the most valuable things that you have to get a HELOC, right? And if you're going to borrow money, HELOC's a great way to borrow money. Don't misunderstand me. There's a place for it. What I'm talking about is then take the HELOC to buy a high cash value structured policy. Most of the time, 90% of the time that I have seen, they're Frankenstein policies, right? So you have that very high cash value, 90-10, 85-15, 80-20, whatever it is. So then you can leverage that to buy a cash flowing asset. I see these all the time. So, James, is there anything wrong with having equity in your home? No. Is there anything wrong with a HELOC? No. You can get out of debt. You can get out of debt with a HELOC. No problem. It's a velocity of money, right? And then we're taking advantage of velocity and arbitrage. I understand. Is there anything wrong with velocity? No, heck no. Unless there's, you know, lead coming at you, you know, then that might be a problem. Okay. Is there anything wrong with buying a life insurance policy? No. Is there anything wrong with leveraging the life insurance policy? No. Is there anything wrong with buying a cash flowing asset? No. What I have a problem with is when you string all of these together, mm-hmm. right? And the people don't understand the infinite banking concept, number one. They don't understand the HELOC, number two. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand the value of the equity in their home, right? And then they don't know anything about cash flowing assets. Yeah. And then the promoters, a group of them normally is what I see. Maybe one guy and he's referring out. He's just creating his four revenue streams of income. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, is this 100% always the way it is? No, I'm not even saying that. This is what I see, and this is what I'm opposed to. He gets a revenue stream, and I'm a capitalist. I'm not against commissions, revenue streams, or profits at all. Right. Okay. But here, this guy gets paid for the mortgage, the note on his HELOC, right? His equity. He gets the revenue stream from the HELOC. He gets a revenue stream from the life insurance policy. Then he gets a revenue stream from the asset that they're selling, which is, you know, some type of real estate most time, cash flowing assets. Is there anything wrong with that? No, it's a combination of all of that. And there's no understanding half the time from the advisors whenever they build these jankly structured policies that are not going to serve the client well. And the client doesn't understand real estate and they've not. And I'm not being disparaging. I'm not making a moral judgment. That's what I do not like.
Right. It's when they don't have the full education of what they're walking themselves into. They have no experience. Right. And so, yeah, it works perfect until it doesn't.
Yeah, that's right.
It works perfect until somebody doesn't pay the rent.
Yeah. You know, that reminds me, like 10 years ago, it seems like everybody was going to their mom and dad or their grandfather or grandmother or whatever and saying, hey, you know, I want to be in the real estate business, the son, the daughter, whatever, the grandchild. Yeah. I want to be a flipper, you know, I want to mm-hmm. fix and flip homes. I don't have any capital. And you go to all these real estate programs that show you how to raise your revenue and it's, oh, go talk to your family and your friends and get them to do a self-directed IRA. And the consumer didn't know anything about them. And then loan me the money to fix and flip. I don't know how many train wrecks I've seen from that.
Man.
I mean, you know.
I have no experience. I just, you know, stayed in Holiday Inn Express last night and went to a conference.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.